We don't normally tell stories about photography. Photographs are better enjoyed with the eyes rather than the ears, but we're making an exception for this story about a photographer and one of his subjects. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Jim Harrington's a likable man, but the first thing you got to understand is he's kind of an odd guy. He'll tell you that himself.
Well, I'm an odd guy.
Jim makes decisions that would make economists cringe.
I run from money and money runs from me.
What Jim means by that is he'll work on a project he thinks is important, even if it's not going to make him any money. Heck, even if it's going to empty his own bank account. This is a story about one of those projects. Harrington's been a professional photographer for decades. He's taken photos of famous musicians for magazines like Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. But just for fun, in 1998, Jim took portraits of two 86-year-old men, both former climbers who had made some of the first ascents in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Harrington's always liked climbing, and he was interested in these past masters, the men and women who ascended the mountains of the Sierra Nevada back when the equipment didn't help much and there weren't endorsement deals. Jim set out to photograph more of these former Sierra Nevada climbers.
A few have died before I got to them. Many are in elderly shape. You know, I started noticing I was getting these people that were disappearing. I realized no one else was doing this project. And maybe I had a certain responsibility to continue this and get the last remaining people from this era.
So Jim started using the money he was earning from his day job shooting star entertainers like Dolly Parton and the Rolling Stones to track down climbers most people have never heard of. The project grew, first to include pioneering climbers from across the U.S. and then the entire world. And Jim decided there was one particular man he had to track down, an Italian named Riccardo Cassin, who was the first to climb the Walker Spur, a nearly vertical wall of granite in the Alps.
He was just one of the giants. Riccardo Cassin looms large. He's like a Babe Ruth of climbing.
Jim didn't know where Cassin lived or whether he'd be able to find him. And when Jim began his search, the news he was hearing wasn't good.
Cassin wasn't in great shape. That's all I heard at the time. He's not in great shape.
When Riccardo Cassin was born in northern Italy in 1909, he certainly didn't seem destined to become the Babe Ruth of climbing. Back then, most people climbing the nearby Alps were wealthy Brits. Cassin's family was poor. When he was just 3 years old, his father left to take a job as a miner in Canada. He died in an accident before Cassin ever got to see him again.
Riccardo grew up with his mother and his siblings, you know, with pretty much no money.
Cassin left school at 12 to work as a blacksmith's apprentice. When he was 17, he moved to a small town on Lake Como called Lecco so he could work in a steel mill.
But he discovered climbing, like a lot of kids did. They were surrounded by rock walls and the Great Alps. And what started as kind of scrambling and hiking for fun turned into an obsession.
Cassin and his friends called themselves the Lecco Spiders. Sometimes they travel hundreds of kilometers, first by train, then bike, then foot. Cassin's best friend was Vittorio Ratti. Together, throughout the 30s, they scaled mountains in the Alps and the Dolomites.
So you can imagine these limestone Dolomite cliffs were straight up vertical. I mean, this is ferocious and terrifying these days with modern gear. It's just simply astounding to imagine these guys going up with these horrible hobnail boots and the rope just tied around their waist. There was no harness.
And these weren't modern ropes. They were made of hemp.
You know, the rope would snap anyway if he fell on it.
In 1937, Cassin and Ratti became the first to scale a daunting granite wall less than 100 kilometers northeast of Lecco, the Pisbadil. Cassin and Ratti were becoming famous.
They had so much momentum, were just full of it, with the talent and the drive to do it, and Ratti and Cassin were this perfect team. But the war was coming on around Europe, and the fascists were moving in.
At the start of World War II, Cassin worked in a munitions factory, which spared him from fighting on the Italian side against the Allies. Then in 1943, American, British, and Canadian forces invaded Sicily in the southern part of mainland Italy. With the Allies moving up from the south, the Germans increased their control in northern Italy. A puppet government was based just 90 minutes from Cassin's home. By that point, Cassin and Ratti had joined the Italian resistance, and they weren't the only climbers to fight the Nazis. The mountain passes were important strategic points, and the climbers were useful fighters.
They knew the mountains, they knew how to get around, and they could survive up there. So they were very instrumental.
According to one newspaper account, Cassin traveled between resistance cells based in the mountains and stashed weapons in his home. It seemed like he and Ratti were both going to survive the war. But then on April 26th, 1945, as the puppet state was collapsing, Ratti fired on German soldiers who were trying to leave Lecco. The Germans returned fire, and Ratti was killed.
You know, something was taken away when Ratti was killed and the war interrupted that momentum they had, that freewheeling youth. Cassin was a changed man afterwards.
Without his partner and best friend, Cassin still managed impressive climbs in the decades after the war. In 1961, at the age of 52, he led the first ascent of the south wall of Alaska's Mount McKinley, which earned him a congratulatory telegram from President Kennedy. Cassin continued climbing into his 80s, retiring with 2,500 total climbs. But by the time Jim Harrington set out to photograph Ricardo Cassin about a decade ago, the legendary climber was nearing 100 years old. Not only that, it was one of those times Harrington was low on cash. That didn't stop him from trying to track down Cassin.
The communication was all very spotty, and it was all kind of espionage-like. Maybe I would get the phone number of an alpine club in Europe or some kind of shaky contact in Poland. Call Nico at 2 a.m. and he'll give you the phone number that you then call. But I finally got an address for Cassin and could write, and I got in touch with his son, Guido.
Harrington soon learned that Cassin was dying. He headed for Milan to get closer to Cassin and awaited further instructions from Guido.
I remember thinking even at the time that I was going to commit all this, you know, what little money I had, going way up to this remote village and just find out that, you know, maybe he died or I wouldn't find him. But finally got word that I could meet Guido at a train station up near Lecco on Lake Como. So I took a train early in the morning, and there was Guido waiting for me at the train station. And he spoke absolutely no English, and I know three words in Italian. So he gesticulated a lot, which is easy for him because he's Italian. And he took me high up in the hills above Lake Como, where this vigil was taking place. They all knew his father was dying. The little kids were playing in the yard, laughing, drinking lemonade, and the sunshine coming through the trees. It was just beautiful. It almost seemed to have a sepia filter in front of it. And there was the great man. They had him pushed up to the window on the inside of the living room in his chair. And he just looked like a piece of granite himself, just this incredible face and still a strong-looking body. But his face was ravaged. He seemed to have some kind of skin cancer. Too many decades climbing too close to the sun is what I'm suspecting.
Cassin didn't have the energy to speak in his own language, let alone English. But Harrington spent over 3 hours in that room with him, sipping risotto and taking pictures.
You grow up seeing the photographs and reading the stories, and then you're suddenly in the room with them, and you're looking at Cassin, who's 100 and a half. He's just completely worn out. He's dying in front of you, but you just think of the vigor of a guy in the 30s going up through the storms on the Walker Spur. And there is the man. People have talked about, don't you think this is kind of grotesque to show these people at this compromised state? Is it a good idea to show these people withering away and dying? And I think it is. I think it's a celebration of life to show the, you know, the bag that's left that once was, that did all these great things.
Harrington left Cassin in his chair by the window. Guido drove him back to the train station. As they were riding down into town, Harrington caught a glimpse in the distance of the Piz Badil, with its 800-meter wall of granite that Cassin and Ratti had scaled using their hemp ropes. 1 week later, Harrington was in Tuscany when he got word that Ricardo Cassin had died. So far as Jim Harrington knows, he took the last portrait of Ricardo Cassin. In the end, Jim Harrington took portraits of 60 men and women who climbed from the 1920s through 1970s. His goal was to get them published in a book. It wasn't easy. Not long after he photographed Cassine, Harrington had a book deal fall through. He was in such financial trouble that he had to spend a November night sleeping on a park bench in New York City. But this past October, 19 years after he began the project, Jim Harrington's first book, The Climbers, was published.
To see people holding it and enjoying it, which I guess they are, it's turned into be the best year of my life. And it's nice to be out seeing it ended. It's quite a relief also.
And if you flip to page 162, you'll find Jim Harrington's portrait of Ricardo Cassine. Could you describe the photo of Cassine?
I'm outside his house, and he has been parked by this open window, kind of a classic old Italian house with the bigger windows that swing open. And it's a dark room on the inside, and he's sitting in his chair. He's kind of coming out of the darkness, and he's looking out the window, and reflected in the glass are the Italian Alps. You can faintly see out of focus, and you know that's where he's looking.
That's photographer Jim Harrington speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler, and you can find that photo on our website at onlyagame.org.